And our next talk, or our first talk of the day, is by Dr. Libman from Harvard. He's going to talk to us about the older patient. And like I said, it's sort of a nice return going from youth to elderly.
Thanks very much, Steve. It's nice to be here, and one day older than I was yesterday. I was asked to describe the top 10 things to know about older patients with HIV infection. And for the sake of this discussion, and we can argue about whether this is the right definition, for older, because this is what most of the studies use, is going to be over 50 years of age. So I realize that's shocking to many of you, which means I'm about one step away from the grave, but anyway, that's what we're gonna refer to. I have no financial relationships to disclose, other than I'm getting older. So the learning objectives are to identify some epidemiologic characteristics of the older patient with HIV infection. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the impact of HIV on the normal aging process, and also the development of common age-related comorbidities. Then we're going to get into the weeds a bit and talk a bit about cardiovascular disease, although you had a lecture on it yesterday. I'll give you not a different spin, but hopefully a complementary spin in terms of how to think about it in the aging patient. Talk briefly about predisposing conditions to cardiovascular disease, which was also covered yesterday. And premature bone loss, which is going to be an emerging issue in this population as it continues to age. And then lastly, finish up with explaining changing mortality patterns in the modern era of antiretroviral therapy. Each of these will start off with a statement, and you can agree or disagree with the statement, but these are the top 10 things that I could think of. And then most of them will be followed by a bit of the evidentiary base for the statement. This is not meant to be an exhaustive review of the literature. There are other studies that also exemplify the points I'm trying to make. So we start off with an ARS question. Which of the following statements about HIV-infected patients over 50 years of age is false? They present an earlier stage of disease. They constitute 45% of HIV-infected patients. There's an increased risk of developing neurocognitive impairment compared to the general population. They develop certain malignancies earlier than the general population. And last, they are more adherent to medical therapy. So four of these are true and one is false. I want you to identify the false statement. I selected this. Okay. So 63%, the majority of you actually got the right answer. It's not true that they presented at an earlier stage of disease. And in fact, because we're prejudiced to think that people over the age of 50 don't have sex, which isn't true, I don't think, they tend to present later than the average. All the rest of the statements are true. I'm going to show you some evidence that they actually are more adherent to medical therapy than younger patients. All right, so briefly about the epidemiology, and then I'll go through the top 10 after this. As you're aware, since the 1980s, the percentage of HIV-infected individuals over the age of 50 has been increasing. And a lot of that has to do with the great work that's been done with antiretroviral therapy and keeping people alive, so the curve is shifted to the right. Just for some more recent data, in 2015, about 17% of the 40,000 or so newly identified cases of HIV infection were in patients 50 or greater. In that group, African Americans had 43% of cases, Hispanics, Latinos about 17%, so similar to the general population with HIV, communities of color are disproportionately represented. In terms of the total number of people living with HIV in 2014, almost half of the patients were over the age of 50. And in terms of risk behaviors, MSM is the most common mode of transmission in older men, and in heterosexual contact, the most common in older women. And these are just a couple of graphs from the CDC making the points that I showed. Again, a surprisingly large number of new cases of HIV or newly diagnosed cases are in older patients. But I think even more dramatic is you can see in the red bars are all 50 years of age or older. They're all 10-year increments. You can see that the curve is shifting very much to the right in terms of people living with HIV. And this trend is very likely to continue. So here are my issues. Number one, HIV infection, even when controlled, is associated with chronic immune activation that's superimposed upon immunologic senescence that normally occurs in older adults. And this is, I worked a year for UpToDate and then actually went back to Beth Israel. It's a long story. But this is a slide that I stole from them. This is a cartoon showing the effect of normal aging on health. And it's just to make the point that as people get older, their physiologic, and I would argue immunologic, reserves diminish. And it puts them at increased risk of spiraling downward if they have an acute medical event. A classic scenario would be the patient who is older at home, maybe an older woman, has osteoporosis, falls, fractures her hip, goes into the hospital, develops a DVT because they didn't put her on thromboembolic prophylaxis appropriately, then develops an aspiration pneumonia, and you know the rest of the story. The same is true in HIV, except superimposed upon some diminished physiologic reserve, we also have we have chronic immune activation and diminished immunologic competence over time. Issue number two is older persons with HIV may be diagnosed later and have more advanced disease at presentation. And I'll put three, and then I'll show you some data to support both of these. And there's a less robust immunologic response to antiretroviral therapy in this population. This has been well shown in multiple studies. People with HIV that are older tend not to have the same rate of rise of CD4 cell count in response to antiretroviral therapy, and they tend to level off at lower levels than the younger population. So here's a couple of studies looking at immunologic response to antiretroviral therapy. The first is the NA-ACCORD study, over 12,000 treatment-naive patients, immunologic response after 24 months of therapy. Was decreased with increasing age, starting actually at age 40, but there was no effect on viral suppression. So we're just as effective as suppressing the virus in older patients, but not as the antiretroviral therapy isn't as effective in boosting CD4 cell count. And that may or may not have implications in terms of the overall health of the patient. As I think you're aware, many of the complications of HIV, particularly the infectious complications, are greatly diminished as long as we suppress the viral load, regardless of CD4 cell count response. In another study, this was a prospective study that evaluated treatment outcomes in over 3,000 patients, about 400 are over the age of 50, that found despite better virologic control, clinical progression to AIDS was higher. So it may have some clinical import in some patients. Issue number four. In general, older HIV-infected patients have better medication adherence, but an increased risk of drug toxicity. And before I was reviewing this literature, I wasn't sure whether it was true or not that older patients actually are more adherent, but my anecdotal experience in primary care practice is yes. Their lives tend to be a little bit less chaotic, perhaps, and a little bit more organized, and that leads to better medication adherence. But it was also not surprising to realize that they're also going to be at increased risk for drug toxicity because of alterations in renal and hepatic function, maybe protein binding in the serum, et cetera. And actually, the literature tends to bear this out. The literature has reported up to 95% adherence in older HIV-infected patients. I actually don't believe that, but it's pretty good anyway. There's no study that shows 95% adherence is correct. But in a meta-analysis done a few years back, older age did reduce the risk of non-adherence by about 27%. And in this meta-analysis, the studies that were assessing both short-term and long-term non-adherence showed significant reductions in both groups. So that's encouraging. In terms of drug toxicity, higher rates of toxicity have been described to drugs that we know are associated commonly with toxicity, such as protease inhibitors. But this has been demonstrated and seems to be age-related. About twice the rate of adverse events to protease inhibitors in patients older than 60 compared to those under the age of 40. In another study of over 500 treatment-naive patients, they found that regimen changes due to toxicity were associated with increasing age. And as I said before, this may be to alterations that people have, either related to HIV or other comorbidities in terms of their renal hepatic function and ability of proteins in the serum to bind drugs. Number five is HIV-infected patients accumulate traditional age-related diseases at younger chronological age. And the hypothesis here, again, is that increased immune activation and long-term chronic inflammation contribute to premature physiologic aging in this population. And I'll show you a couple of case control studies that demonstrate this point. So this is the first one that was published in Clinical Infectious Disease back in 2011. And it's a case control study, and I'm just going to go over it briefly. These are the cases on this side of HIV. These are the controls. Each of these bars are increments of 10 years of life. And the darker sub-bars are more age-related comorbidities. And so these are the cases. Again, these are the controls. What I want you to do is just some, I realize you can't read it completely in the back, but I want you to do a little pattern recognition and look at this and compare it to this. Look at this and compare it to, where am I? This. And look at this and compare it to this. And what you see here is, at least in this study, is that in terms of traditional age-related comorbidities, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, diabetes, et cetera, patients seem to develop them about a decade earlier than in the uninfected population. So this study, which is bulleted here, was a retrospective analysis from 2002 to 2009. You can see the features that were examined and the independent predictors of polypathology, which means two or more age-related comorbidities included older age, male gender, CD4 nadir below 200, and duration of antiretroviral therapy. Here's another study. It's basically set up the same way, except these are five-year intervals. And again, these are the cases, and these are the controls. And I think you can, again, appreciate that there's a shift one bar to the right in terms of cases compared to controls. So this, the conclusion of this study was that they seem to develop common age-related comorbidities earlier, but on this one, it looked closer to about 5 years earlier. And I think this confirms anecdotally, at least what I've perceived in clinical practice, is that the things that you think patients are at risk for and may develop seem to blossom a bit earlier in HIV-infected patients, even if they're virally controlled. Again, from this study, these are looking at particular medical comorbidities, and you can see red is HIV-infected, blue is HIV-uninfected, and you can see that for all of the common medical comorbidities, they were more common in the HIV-infected population, but reached statistical significance for hypertension, myocardial infarction, peripheral vascular disease, and impaired renal function. But the trends on all the other parameters was similar. Number six is the incidence of coronary disease is higher than that in HIV-negative patients matched for age and gender. And the CAD risk calculator results need to be interpreted in the context of this increased risk in the HIV-infected population. I know this was discussed yesterday. I'm not going to spend a long time on this, but I do want to show you a few points that pertain to aging and cardiovascular disease. So first we'll start off with an ARS question, and you should get this right if you were listening yesterday. HIV infection has been associated with the following increased percentage risk of acute myocardial infarction beyond that explained by traditional risk factors. 10%, 20%, 30%, 50% or more. Different studies have shown different results, but I want to get your general sense of where you think this is. You obviously were not listening yesterday. This is very discouraging. So I think, as was described yesterday, studies vary, but even the most conservative studies show at least a 50% increase. And some of the studies that were described yesterday show 100% or more increase. And I'm going to show you a systematic analysis that confirms that internationally. It's not just in the United States. So the correct answer was actually the last one, 50% or more. So just to review the basics, again, since it doesn't seem like you remembered much from yesterday, the incidence of coronary disease is higher in HIV-negative patients matched for age and gender. Studies have demonstrated this both in a subclinical and also a clinical realm. HIV is associated with increased soluble and cellular markers of inflammation, endothelial dysfunction, and altered coagulation. And this is true even in people who are virally suppressed. And all of these have been associated with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. In fact, most chronic inflammatory and infectious diseases are associated with an increased risk of atherosclerosis. However, the degree to which HIV, some of the medications we traditionally use to treat HIV, and other unidentified risks in this population are unknown. We do know that there's a high prevalence of certain traditional risk factors, particularly cigarette smoking, in this population, higher than the general population. In terms of drug classes, the one that's been demonstrated most clearly for an increased risk are protease inhibitors, and we don't use those for initial therapy in the vast majority of patients nowadays, and there have been some conflicting data about abacavir and also efavirenz over time. What we do know is that discontinuation of antiretroviral therapy, this was also discussed yesterday, is not a wise strategy, obviously, because patients do better both in terms of cardiovascular risk and also overall health if they remain on effective treatment. This is one study that I'll just bring to your attention that shows a little bit more modest effect on cardiovascular disease risk, but I thought it was nicely done, so I'll just present it briefly. This was a study looking at case control study. On the top are uninfected patients. On the bottom are HIV-infected patients. Each of these are 10-year periods of life. And they were basically looking for the risk of myocardial infarction based upon whether the patient was infected or uninfected after adjusting for traditional risk factors for atherosclerosis. And I'll just bring your attention down to this last line across here, which is the incident rate ratio, the likelihood of having an MI if you're HIV infected compared to uninfected in each decade of life. And you can see from 30 to 39, it was 2.19, but the confidence intervals cross 1. For 40 to 49, it was 1.34. This was statistically significant. For 50 to 59, 1.80, statistically significant. And for 60 to 69, 1.53, again, statistically significant. So in this study, the overall increased risk attributable to HIV infection was about 50%. And again, this is more modest than has been shown in some other studies. This is a systematic analysis looking at the risk of cardiovascular events, myocardial infarction, and stroke, and these are all individual studies. This is the one line, which is this of risk ratio, so everything to the right of one means an increased risk, and these are the pooled data results with the confidence intervals, and you can see, just look at the pooled data results for a minute, that for all of these, cardiovascular events, myocardial infarction, and stroke, we're all at about two times the risk compared to the general population. So I think a general rule of thumb right now is to think about 50 to 100% increased risk. And this obviously has implications for how you use these risk calculators, and this is probably the most common one that's used right now, the ACC-AHA-CV risk calculator. And as was mentioned yesterday, at least in more recent publications, there is a recognition that people have HIV infection and they may be at increased risk for coronary disease, and there are certain drugs we should and shouldn't be using. But there's very little data that provide us with good guidance in terms of how to manage these patients, at least the ones that are at risk for cardiovascular disease. And I'd be happy to discuss at least what I do when we get to the question and answer period, but I'm sure your approaches may be just as good. Traditional risk factors for atherosclerosis, just to review a few points about what's changed over the past few years. In newer published recommendations, the ACC-AHA published a revised hypertension guideline last year. They recommend, where available, the use of ambulatory monitoring for diagnosis. There's also a new definition for hypertension and treatment targets, which is basically 130 over 80 in most patient populations. And importantly, there are no important drug interactions with antiretrovirals for the most part. For diabetes, it's been demonstrated that there's an increased risk of diabetes in people with HIV. It's been known for several years now that the hemoglobin A1C may underestimate the degree of glycemia in these patients. So you may get a false negative hemoglobin A1C when you're trying to diagnose diabetes, and you may be more optimistic than you should about how people are doing on treatment. And lastly, that not surprisingly, that diabetes and HIV have a combined detrimental effect on renal function that's probably synergistic. In terms of hyperlipidemia, this was discussed yesterday, but simvastatin and lovastatin generally can't be used with protease inhibitors and cobicistat. The preferred drugs are atorvastatin and rosuvastatin. I've never used pitavastatin, but that's also one of the recommended drugs. I think in this patient population, particularly on patients where drug-drug interactions are a possibility, as opposed to throwing everybody on 80 milligrams of atorvastatin, like our cardiologists do in Boston, it makes sense to start off low and go gradually and actually monitor for drug toxicity, including LFTs and CPK. That's not a recommendation for the general population, but I think it's prudent in this population. And lastly, cigarette smoking. HIV-infected patients are clearly more likely to smoke than the general population and less likely to quit. And as was mentioned yesterday, this is probably one of the most important, if not the most important, health interventions you can implement for your HIV-infected patient. There's no data that one approach works better than another, and like most things in primary care, you need to individualize. Issue 7 is HIV infection and its treatment and comorbidities have been associated with premature bone loss. So osteopenia, osteoporosis, and pathological fractures have been described. Osteonecrosis has also been described, but that's not really considered premature bone loss. In general, osteopenia is an asymptomatic condition, but when the T scores get down to -1 to -2.5, which is the threshold for osteoporosis, it's wise to do a FRAX calculation because depending upon what the patient's risk is for a major osteoporotic fracture or a hip fracture, that may also warrant bisphosphonate therapy. Osteoporosis traditionally presents with fractures of vertebrae, forearms, or hips. I'll show you some data that in HIV patients, the places where they fracture may not be the most typical places. And then again, as with everything else in this condition, HIV probably plays a role. The use of TDF, protease inhibitors, there's been some suggestion of alteration in vitamin D metabolism. And especially patients that have had HIV for many years and were on some of the older nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors such as DDI and D4T, low-grade lactic acidemia may also contribute to premature bone loss. You're all aware of the other risk factors. Sometimes we focus on the HIV and forget that people are not moving, they're smoking, they're drinking too much, they're on steroids. In males particularly, they may be hypogonad. All of these can contribute to premature bone loss. The optimal use of bone densitometry is not clear, and there's really no studies informing how to use it. That being said, the HIV Medicine Association in the last iteration of the HIV primary care guidelines from 2013 advised getting a baseline DEXA scan in postmenopausal women, which is the same as the general population recommendations, but also in men 50 years of age or older. And I'd say, quite frankly, in our practice, there's a lot of variability in terms of whether people are doing this. Calcium and vitamin D should be given in any patients that have premature bone loss, and regular exercise and smoking cessation are very important, in addition to considering bisphosphonate therapy in appropriate patients. So a couple of studies just showing the drugs associated with this. This is one study that dates back about five or six years. Looking at different drug classes, you can see from some of the drugs that are listed on the bottom, this was done in earlier than 5 or 6 years ago. Anything above one and that does not include one in the confidence intervals is statistically significant. And you see the drug name and then the drug listed with one and two. Those are different multivariate analyses. And the long and the short here is you can see the TDF was clearly associated with an increased risk of osteoporotic fractures in this study. And there was some suggestion that protease inhibitors might be as well. All of the other nucleoside drugs and non-nucleoside drugs did not appear to be. This is another study looking at the use of TDF in particular, and both for the risk for any fracture and then also traditional osteoporotic fractures. And for each of these, this says ever versus never, on versus off, cumulative. A couple of interesting things to note. One is the trend for basically all of these is to the right of one, which means an increased risk. Some of these results are not statistically significant. For any fracture, it seems that ever versus never and on and off was more associated with it than cumulative TDF therapy over 5 years. And I don't quite understand that, but if you look at the multivariate analysis here, it's one is within the confidence intervals. For osteoporotic fractures, again, the tendency is to be at increased risk, but all of these confidence intervals include one, so it means they're not statistically significant. So a couple of things here. One is it may not be how long the patient's been on TDF. That's one thing to remember. And the other thing to remember is it looks like the tendency is towards any fracture increased risk rather than the traditional fractures we think associated with osteoporosis. So you need to keep your eyes and ears open, and it may be that if somebody fractures something with minor trauma and it's not in a traditional area for osteoporotic fractures, just to think about whether this could still be related to osteoporosis. Issue 8 is increasing age may be a risk factor for HIV-associated neurocognitive dysfunction, although studies examining this issue are limited. There's very poor literature looking at neurocognitive dysfunction and psychiatric and psychological conditions in the aging HIV-infected patient, and we certainly need more research in the area. The studies that are available would suggest that depression is more common and also neurocognitive dysfunction, when it's tested for, is probably more common as well. And again, this may be, at least the second, may be related to chronic inflammatory state. Issue 9, lung, hepatic, and anal cancers occur at a younger age in HIV-infected adults compared to seronegative persons. And again, the whole issue of people developing age-related comorbidities at a somewhat younger age. And this is one study looked at 15 HIV and cancer registry databases in the U.S., including over 200,000 persons with age, and looking at the age of diagnosis of non-AIDS-defining cancers. And only lung and anal cancers were seen in AIDS patients at a younger age, but about 5 years younger than expected. And these are cancers that you would expect to be seen more commonly in this population just because the risk factors are more common, so HPV infection and also cigarette smoking. But again, 5 years earlier. All right, ARS question. I think this is the last ARS question. Which of the following statements regarding mortality in the modern era of ART is false? Overall mortality rate has declined over the past two decades, and increasing percentage of causes of death are related to non-AIDS-defining conditions. The highest percentage of deaths are in the 25 to 34 age group, and life expectancy of a 20-year-old recently diagnosed with HIV has been modeled to be similar to that of the general population. Three of these are true and one is false. Okay, you did great on this one. So this was an easier one. I'll show you some data in a moment to support that. Mortality, last one, is mortality in HIV-infected persons has fallen substantially over the past two decades, with non-AIDS-related conditions now occurring for the majority of deaths. And this is a curve from the CDC showing the annual rates of deaths due to HIV infection by age group, and you can see at all age groups, dating back to the advent of effective antiretroviral therapy, they've dropped precipitously. But the mortality trends are kind of interesting, but not unexpected. This is one study, the DAD study, looking at deaths that occurred following from 1999 through 2011 and looking at the trends over time. AIDS-related causes were responsible for 29% of deaths, non-AIDS-related cancers for 15, liver disease for 13, and cardiovascular disease for 11. The important points here are, though, that deaths attributable to AIDS-related events decreased by about one half, from 34 to 22%, and the proportion of non-AIDS-defining malignancies increased from 9 to 23%. And these are the trends in the percentage distributions of death due to HIV according to age group. And you can see that over time, the higher percentage is in the higher age group, which makes perfect sense because they're developing age-related comorbidities. And then I think this is my last slide. This is one modeling study that's been done. There have been some others done as well. And this was mentioned yesterday that suggests that everything else being equal, the life expectancy of someone with HIV is similar to that of someone without HIV. And this was looking at different years of diagnosis from 2000 to 2007. And with adjustments for sex and transmission group and race and baseline CD4 cell count at ART initiation. And you can see that the expected life expectancy of a 20-year-old, at least back in 2006-07, and it's probably better now, was 51 years, which is pretty comparable to the general population. Obviously, some groups, based upon transmission and race and CD4 cell count, may fare somewhat better than others on average. And I will stop there and be happy to take your questions. Thank you.
Okay, if you have questions, the mics are there, and we're going to start on some of the written questions. Why does hemoglobin A1C underestimate hyperglycemia in HIV patients? Is it because of a shorter red blood cell half-life?
Does this work?
Yeah.
Yes, okay, thank you. I don't know the physiologic. I don't know the explanation in terms of laboratory functioning why that occurs. I'm not sure if anybody in the audience does. It's been well described, though, and I think the way to use it clinically is, number one, in a diabetic patient, again, the hemoglobin A1C may underestimate, may make you more optimistic about their degree of glycemic control than the general patient with diabetes. And the other may be in a case of borderline diabetes where you're trying to assess whether someone actually has the condition or not. It may give you a false negative result.
Can you discuss the use of Repatha? I'm sorry, I don't know the generic for cholesterol in this patient population.
Sorry, which
drug? Repatha.
What is Repatha?
What is Repatha? It's the injectable.
I don't have any experience using it in HIV-infected patients or other patients, quite frankly. Does anybody want to make mention of it?
No. Okay. What can we do with the neurocognitive deficits in our patients since they're dealing with it earlier and may be living with it longer?
This is a really important issue, and I think what we need to do first is understand more about what's going on. There is some suggestion that neurocognitive dysfunction is more, I think it's pretty clear that if you test people for neurocognitive function, that you find more deficits than you might expect based upon subjective complaints. I also think there's some evidence that suggests that with aging in general, neurocognitive dysfunction may worsen a bit in HIV-infected individuals. We have very little information on depression and aging, but I wouldn't be surprised if the same is also true with depression. So the first is recognizing it, screening for it if you can screen for it. And there are office-based screening modalities, both at least for gross neurocognitive dysfunction and also for depression. And then just making sure you actively ask patients about it, because some patients may be disinclined to share the information with you unless you actually ask.
We take a question here.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for your talk. I was struck by the slide that shows risk of fracture with ever use of TDF and on and off use of TDF, and it made me think about the population of folks that I serve that are PrEP users, so not people living with HIV, but on PrEP, and how that might impact them as well.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't think we have any information or any good information on PrEP users. Again, these are studies in HIV-infected patients, and there are clearly other risks for premature bone loss in the population. So I don't think you can extrapolate to PrEP users, but it does. I agree with you. I think the results were not intuitive to me, and I'm not sure exactly. It's one study, and I've learned over time not to overinterpret results from one study, but it does give you pause for thought. And hopefully at some point in the not-too-distant future, we'll be able to use TAF for PrEP and avoid this issue.
Good morning. Thank you for the talk. And using the cardiovascular risk factors, you get a 10% risk. How do you adjust it? And do you adjust it further if somebody has a CD4 less than 200 versus normal CD4?
Yeah, I wish I could give you a sophisticated answer. I can't. I do an upward adjustment, and I'm conservative in my practice. So what I tell these are situations like, you know, whenever there's medical literature and you have to incorporate it into clinical practice, you always have to individualize it. And to make this more complicated, this is an area where we don't have sufficient data to make informed decisions. I tell the patient first that their actual risk of their 10-year risk of a cardiovascular event is almost definitely higher than what we're getting through the risk calculator. I tell them exactly what I told you today, that there are studies that suggest that it might be 50% or greater higher. So what I do in practice is I adjust that by 50%. Okay. And I have no idea whether that's the right thing to do or not. And then I have a discussion with them. So, for patients that are very, very low, it doesn't make all that much difference. For patients that are 10 or 20%, it doesn't make a difference. It probably makes a difference for patients in the 5 to 10% range, where you really need to have a conversation with the patient anyway. And my own approach has been to be more aggressive about prescribing statin therapy. But as was mentioned yesterday, there's a large study that's ongoing, REPRIEVE, to look at actually clinical endpoints for statin use in HIV infection.
Yeah, thanks. I think this is related to the last question, actually. As I recall, that 10% came from earlier case control cohort studies, observational studies, rather, at Kaiser, the VA, back in the early 2000s. In that time, I believe that an attributable risk of about 10% to HIV alone, and then another 10% to protease inhibitor use was identified, and that the majority of the cardiovascular risk was attributable to the standard risk factors, quite different than what we're seeing in these later studies. Do you have any thoughts on what the difference would be?
Yeah, I agree with you. That's my recollection as well, and I'm not sure. I would say I think the majority of the studies show a more pronounced increase associated with HIV infection itself. I think some of the confounding factors like protease inhibitor use are falling by the wayside now. So we have fewer patients that are on protease inhibitors. Whether treatment in the past with protease inhibitors for people who have lived with HIV for many years needs to be included in the calculation is not entirely clear. But I don't have an explanation. I think 50%, though, is actually a conservative estimate of the increased risk. So I it needs to be individualized, but I manage patients with that information in hand.
So I'm going to summarize a few questions fairly quickly. There's several questions about bone disease and vitamin D. There's evidently a meta-analysis showing vitamin D did not benefit bone mineral density or fracture decrease. And then the other questions are, how do you dose your calcium and vitamin D if you do use it? So if you could just sort of...
Yeah, vitamin D is a, you know... So everybody in Boston is vitamin D deficient, as near as I can tell. Yep. So I stopped actually checking it, and I just tell everybody to take 800 to 1,000 units of vitamin D. It's not going to prevent your bones from fracturing, but I think having a low vitamin D level probably does not help. So the recommendations in general, unless I happen to have a level on the patient, which is not routinely done by me at least, but is done by some providers, if it's very, very low, which you see occasionally, those are patients that generally get 50,000 units a week for 4 to 8 weeks and then are placed on 1,000 units a day. If it's in the 20 to 30 range, which is considered insufficiency rather than deficiency, whatever that means, then I just have them start 1,000 units. If we don't want to check a vitamin D level, then I just have them start 1,000 units. For calcium, it matters whether they are dairy consumers or not. If they're dairy consumers, 500 to 600 milligrams of calcium per day should be adequate. If they're not, then taking that twice a day should do it. A lot of patients complain of constipation if they take it twice a day. Most people can tolerate one calcium pill a day without much difficulty.
And then one last comment sort of coming from these that concerns about metformin interactions with dolutegravir and calcium with dolutegravir.
And what?
Calcium with dolutegravir absorption.
Yeah, so there are issues associated with some drugs. Metformin and dolutegravir, which I didn't actually mention up there, I don't think, is one concern. Metformin in otherwise has not been a big problem with other modern antiretroviral drugs. With some of the older drugs like D4T and DDI that can also produce lactic acidemia, there was concern that putting patients on two drugs could superimposed with overlapping toxicities could augment that response. But obviously very few patients are on those types of regimens nowadays, especially in the U.S.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.